All right, good morning. This is George Collins, and for the next hour I'll be reading from the Democrat and Chronicle for today, which I believe is October 16th, 2025. Let me first of all start off with an encouraging article about the nursing home industry. Six nursing homes in Monroe County were named among the best in New York State, according to Newsweek. Among them, the Jewish home on South Winton Road in Brighton topped the list of America's best nursing homes 2026 as one of the largest facilities considered, with more than 150 beds, according to Newsweek. This year marks the fifth consecutive year that the Jewish home was on the list and the second straight year that the facility ranked first in New York. According to the publication, the list features 1,200 nursing homes across 33 states, according to data from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and is intended to assist older adults and their families as they consider long-term care options. More than 90 nursing homes in New York are included in Newsweek's 2026 list. Facilities, according to Newsweek's global editor-in-chief Nancy Cooper, were selected after the publication considered performance data, recommendations of medical professionals, accreditations, and resident satisfaction. Other nursing homes in the Rochester region within the top 10 on the 2026 Newsweek list, in addition to the Jewish home in Brighton, Maplewood in Webster, the Maplewood in Webster, New York, ranks second in New York among nursing homes with 50 to 99 beds. It has 74 certified beds and accepts both Medicare and Medicaid. Next, Aaron Manor Rehabilitation and Nursing Center in Penfield ranks second statewide among nursing homes with 100 to 149 beds. It has 140 beds and accepts both Medicare and Medicaid. The Edna Tina Wilson Living Center in Greece ranks fifth in New York State among nursing homes with 100 to 149 beds. It has 120 beds and accepts both Medicare and Medicaid. Friendly Senior Living Friendly Home in Brighton ranked sixth in New York among nursing homes with more than 150 beds. It has 200 certified beds and accepts both Medicare and Medicaid. Lastly, Wegman Family Cottages at Park Ridge Living Center in Greece ranks seventh statewide among nursing homes with 100 to 149 beds. It has 120 beds and accepts both Medicare and Medicaid. All right. Here's an interesting article about how a school principal became a Buffalo Bills superfan with a mask and a mission. Frank Barber has not always been a Buffalo Bills fan. In fact, his first time inside the Bills Highmark Stadium, he was rooting for the Steelers. Just a second here. But now, every Sunday, you can find him sitting in the front row as his super fan alter ego, which is Hannibal Lecter. Cute. He's been a season ticket holder since 1999 and started attending the games as Hannibal over a decade ago. That's spelled H-A-N-N-A-B-I-L-L. So he started attending the games as Hannibal over a decade ago as a way to boost spirits in the years the team was down on their luck. Every game day, he makes the two-hour trek from his Steuben County home to Orchard Park, arriving at the stadium parking lot with several others right when it opens. Mr. Barber is a middle school principal in Painted Post, New York by day, and then transforms into Buffalo Bills superfan Hannibal for Bills home games, for Bills home games. At Highmark Stadium. He has been a season ticket holder since 1999. And very interesting story. In that same parking lot, almost 2 hours before every game, Barber undergoes a transformation. He sneaks off to slather a coat of blue paint onto his freshly shaved head, and then he recruits his son, or a friend, or a young fan standing nearby to make sure the back of his head, all the way down to his cheekbones, is completely covered. As Barber slides on a hand-painted, Bills-themed Hannibal Lecter-esque mask, only then does he take on the Hannibal persona. But if you were to ask him how he feels about his current popularity status, he'd say the title makes him a bit uncomfortable. Barber says, "I don't ever take it too seriously about being considered a super fan. I think I'm a very fortunate fan to be able to go to so many games and all those things, and I think it's great that people recognize me and want to take pictures and all that. It's just fun." And he uses his fame to support teachers and students. He also used the fame for good. A middle school principal by day, Barber occasionally gives his fourth ticket to a teacher in the area. Last year, an educator in his school district, earned the spot, and ahead of this coming season, a teacher from a nearby district won the giveaway. His alter ego has helped boost his school's fundraising efforts, too. Offering to dress up as Hannibal during school hours seems to be a pretty good incentive for his students to exceed a food drive goal, as they've done it every time. And while it might seem like all fun and games on the outside, being a season ticket holder has a deeper meaning for Principal Barber. It's time with the people he loves that he might not get otherwise. Barber said, "The whole experience is something that is so important to me. I don't spend enough time with my son and my family and friends, and so this is an opportunity to do that. When the Bills schedule comes out, I see it as an opportunity every time to put everything else aside except the Bills, family, friends, and I'm grateful for that." All right. And that report was written by Emily Barnes. Very nice. Let's see what else we got here. Here's a nice article, Finger Lakes. I'm just getting off a cold, everybody. I'm sorry, I'm clearing my throat. Finger Lakes named the American Wine Region of the Year by National Magazine. The Finger Lakes Wine Region has been named the Wine Enthusiast Magazine's American Wine Region of the Year. This year marks the magazine's 26th annual Wine Star Awards. They honor the individuals and companies that make outstanding contributions to the wine and beverage industry. The story announcing the award said that New York's largest wine-growing region has come a mighty long way in a few decades. Where wine lovers once had to search for quality, these days it's the norm. The Finger Lakes history began in 1829 with the first plantings along Keuka Lake, and evolved through the pioneering work of Frenchman Charles Fournier and Ukrainian horticulturist Konstantin Frank. The magazine noted that a few decades later, German-born Hermann Weimer took Riesling to whole new heights, setting a bar that continues to be raised by the multinational team at the winery. The Finger Lakes AVA is shaped by 11 deep glacial lakes that create ideal conditions for slow, balanced ripening of grapes. The region now, encompassing more than 140 wineries, making a wide variety of wines. Among the region's strengths are its sparkling wines, as well as Riesling and Cabernet Franc. The magazine noted that the cultivating wine grapes with the area's challenging weather conditions isn't easy. The magazine wrote that considering most Finger Lakes producers are self-funded mom-and-pop operations without access to the deep corporate pockets enjoyed in other wine regions, the region's success feels even more like a David versus Goliath situation. This honor from Wine Enthusiast magazine celebrates not only the Finger Lakes, but the strength and evolution of New York's entire wine community, said Sam Filler, who's the executive director of the New York Wine and Grape Foundation. The American Wine Region of the Year Award affirms what generations of growers and winemakers have known, that the Finger Lakes define what cool climate excellence looks like in America. This recognition highlights our community's shared success and innovation, proving that when the Finger Lakes grows, the entire New York wine industry grows. We're honored to work alongside the New York Wine and Grape Foundation and our peers to showcase the region's authentic story to the world, said Amy Naver, executive director of the Finger Lakes Wine Alliance. The Finger Lakes stands as a testament to resilience and collaboration, where generations of growers and new wineries work together to craft exceptional cool climate wines. The magazine's 26th annual Wine Star Awards Gala will be held at the Glass House in New York City on January 26th. Let's see what's going on in the world of business. Wow. Orvis, major sporting goods chain, is closing nearly half of its stores. Outdoor and sporting goods chain Orvis, which has three retail stores in New York, announced its closing over almost half of its location nationwide by early 2026. Orvis President Simon Perkins told U.S. Today in an October 10th statement, the company plans on reducing the products it sells, as well as shuttering 31 stores and 5 outlets due to the, quote, unprecedented tariff landscape, close quote. We are entering an exciting new chapter by returning to our roots and sharpening our focus on the pursuits at the heart of our heritage. In other words, fly fishing and wing shooting, said Perkins. This focus is about more than products. It's about ensuring that Orvis continues to lead in innovation and serve our angling and upland communities and protect wild places that we love. Here's what to know. What does Orvis sell? The Vermont-based company, which currently has a footprint of 70 retail locations across the U.S., started as a fly fishing equipment store in 1856. Wow. Before expanding into sportswear, fine gifts, home furnishings, luggage, and travel accessories, according to the company's website. The company also has over 550 retail partners like Bass Pro, Cabela's and Sportsman's Warehouse. It currently employs 1,500 people nationwide, and an unknown number of whom will be affected by the closures. We know this impacts people who are significant members of the Orvis family, said Perkins, and we are deeply grateful to our associates who have done an exceptional job embodying the Orvis brand and core values for our local communities. Let me take this moment to remind you that you are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Democrat and Chronicle on the Niagara Frontier Radio reading service. Where are Orvis retail stores in New York? There are three retail stores in New York State, according to the company's website. Here's where they are. In Williamsville, which is a suburb outside of Buffalo, at 4545 Transit Road, and then New York City, 489 Fifth Avenue, and then a place called Millbrook, which presumably is either downstate or central New York. They are at a place called 3047 Sharon Turnpike Road. Okay. Let's see what else we got here. Now here's a kind of a Law and Order story. A man was wanted in a chaotic Canandaigua drug case. He was arrested after 7 months on the run. a man wanted for nearly 7 months, who police said hit a vehicle and drove away on a sidewalk while evading a potential drug arrest in Canandaigua in March, has been arrested. Jonathan Matthews was taken into custody on October 15th by U.S. Marshals, according to Canandaigua Police Chief Matthew Nielsen. Matthews is charged with two counts of third-degree criminal sale of a controlled substance, second-degree reckless endangerment, unlawful fleeing, reckless driving, and various traffic citations, according to the police. On March 17th, members of the Canandaigua Police Department and Ontario County Sheriff's Office Special Investigation Units tried to apprehend Matthews after a lengthy narcotics investigation, said police. Police said Matthews fled the scene in a vehicle on Bristol Street, Canandaigua, and then hit an unmarked police vehicle before driving onto a sidewalk to evade apprehension. A pursuit was halted, police said, because Matthews was speeding and driving erratically. During the investigation, the Canandaigua Police Department was assisted by the Ontario County Sheriff's Office Special Investigative Unit. That's a mouthful. The City of Geneva Police Department, the Ontario County Sheriff's Office Warrant Unit, and the U.S. Marshals and Task Force members. Well, that's certainly enough manpower to get this guy, and they were successful. Okay. In other business news, there is a new TJ Maxx in Victor that is opening up. TJ Maxx, as we all know, is an off-price retailer that will open its new store in Victor on October 23rd at 8 a.m. at 20 Square Drive, which is the old Bed Bath & Beyond space in Eastgate Square Plaza. The original location in nearby Cobblestone Court opened in 2017 and occupied about 21,000 square feet of space. The new store measures more than 28,000 square feet. On opening day, the Victor store will stay open until 10 p.m. Regular hours will be 9:30 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. daily. Other TJ Maxx stores in the Rochester region. Let's see here. And we'll get to that. Well, the other six locations in the Rochester region include Brockport, Webster, Pittsford, Victor, Canandaigua, and Geneseo. TJ Maxx now has more than 1,300 stores in 49 states and Puerto Rico. It was founded in 1977. The Framingham, Massachusetts-based chain sells name brand and designer fashions, accessories, jewelry, home goods, and beauty products at discount prices. What else? In sports news, the Buffalo Bills release a long shot who became a fan favorite on the show Hard Knocks that I think was shown on The Buffalo Bills released the player who won over fans on Hard Knocks during an emotional call home from Highmark Stadium. The team announced that it released linebacker Jimmy Chiarlo on Tuesday. Chiarlo is a 24-year-old West Point graduate who put his military service on hold while he pursued his football dreams. That's West Point graduate, wow. He was cut near the end of the preseason and later signed to the Bills practice squad. Chiarlo was signed from the practice squad to the active roster on October 4th. He was inactive for the team's Week 6 matchup at Atlanta. Maybe they should have put him in. What a terrible game. Now, how did Jimmy Chiarello become a star on the TV show Hard Knocks? He was signed by Buffalo during the preseason when the Bills' linebacking corps was dealing with injuries to Terrell Bernard, Dorian Williams, and Shaq Thompson, and the team had just waived the often injured Baylen Specter. Chiarello, who went to high school in New Jersey, then made four tackles against the New York Giants, which the biggest one being that he blew up Giants return man Dante Miller. Pardon me. All right. Chiarello, who went to high school in New Jersey, made four tackles against the New York Giants, the biggest one being when he blew up the Giants return man Dante Miller. The next episode of Hard Knocks featured a locker room clip where head coach Sean McDermott singled out Chiarello for praise. Whoever's on the field, it doesn't matter, McDermott said in a team meeting. That's what we're looking for. Physical, nasty, making plays, flying around, being a difference maker. There's going to be three guys that make this team solely on special teams because of plays like this. McDermott told Chiarello to raise his hand so that he could see where he was, he said. That's a heck of a play, man. I know you just joined us a couple days ago, man. Great job. That's playoff caliber work right there. So your reps are going to move up. You make plays like this in any capacity, in any phase, then you earn more playing time, said McDermott. I don't care what your name is or where you were drafted or what your status was last year. I don't really care. You earn the right to play on this team. Chiarello told Veterans Bills reporter Sal Majorana that his phone blew up the moment the episode aired. Chiarello said it was really cool to get texts from friends and family. My little brother texted me and said that my family was at home watching and it was like the ball drop on New Year's Eve, so that was pretty cool to hear. The support's been amazing, but at the same time, I'm not trying to make it a distraction from the goals that I'm trying to achieve here. One of Hard Knock's most memorable moments was when Chiarello called his dad from an empty Highmark Stadium. Oh, I remember that. His dad delivered one of the best pick-me-up speeches of all time. Mr. Chiarello said, "Son, you got to give it everything you got and leave everything on the field, and good things will happen. Everyone back home is so proud. Everyone is just going crazy." The scene was instantly relatable to any parent, and I certainly would agree with that. The Bills also released a cornerback by the name of Jalen Kimber, who they had signed to the practice squad on October 7th. So he had a cup of coffee with the Bills, and he is now gone, which is the way football works. It's a business. All right, let's see what else we got here. Fall colors are peaking in the Rochester area. And we've got some beautiful photographs, which obviously you can't see, so I'm going to move on. Sorry about that. Here's a story. Let's see. Local kicker had a big moment during the 1987 strike in this memorable game. Let's see what we can find here about that. No, that ain't it. Sorry. Bear with me. Okay. The game was October 18th, 1987. The outcome of the game was between the Bills and the Giants, and the Bills won 6-3. There have been hundreds and hundreds of games played at the stadium in Orchard Park during its 53 years in existence, but there has never been a worst brand of NFL football on display than there was on this unforgettable day. In 1987, the NFL Players Association went on strike. And rather than cancel games, the owners imported replacement players to fill their rosters so that the season could continue, though 1 week of play was lost in the transition. The Buffalo Bills' scab players, we'll call them, let's just say, were unimpressive, and they lost their first game, 47-6 at Rich Stadium. Remember that? It was Rich Stadium. To the Colts, though that was mainly because NFL veteran quarterback Gary Hogaboom crossed the picket line and played for Indianapolis, throwing for 318 yards and 5 touchdowns in what was surely a day he wasn't all that proud of. They were competitive the following week, but still lost 14-7 at New England. And with a 1-3 record, the real Players had opened at 1-1, they came home to host the New York Giants in what everyone knew would be the final scab game, because a new collective bargaining agreement had been hammered out during the week. The strike had already been weakening, and players were slowly returning to their teams, so the Bills had players such as running back Rob Riddick, tight end Keith McKellar, center Will Grant, and defensive end Leon Seals for this game, for which an announced crowd of just over 15,000 showed up. But the Giants, who had won the previous year's Super Bowl, were far better positioned to win because they had eighth-year veteran quarterback Jeff Rutledge and a guy named Lawrence Taylor, LT, who the year before had won the NFL's MVP award while leading the Giants to their first Super Bowl victory, and in just his sixth NFL season was already being considered one of the greatest defensive players in the history of the NFL. LT was by far the biggest NFL star to cross the picket line and play with the scabs, and predictably, he terrorized the Bills. Yet rather incredibly, the Bills wound up on the winning end in a game that was comical in every way. The teams combined for 9 fumbles. 9 fumbles. Wow. 4 lost, all by the Bills. 5 interceptions, 26 penalties for 258 yards, 5 missed field goals, oh my God, and 48 incomplete passes. However, what a finish. In fact, you could almost say it was straight from Hollywood. Todd Schlope, who grew up in Orchard Park and after a career as a World Cup skier didn't pan out, he went to the University of Michigan, and while earning a degree in film study, he was a kickoff specialist for 2 seasons, playing for legendary Wolverines coach Bo Schembechler, Schembechler in the early 1980s. Upon graduation, he went to training camp with the Bills in 1985, but lost out in a wide-open 10-kicker competition to, remember this guy, Scott Norwood. Not sold on Norwood, the Bills invited Schlope to camp in 1986, but he instead tried to win a job with the Seahawks and lost out to a guy named Norm Johnson. Again, in 1987, the Bills called to Schlope, and again, Norwood won. But this time, with the strike looming, general manager Bill Polian, one of the all-time greats, Bill Polian offered him $5,000 to be the Bills kicker if, indeed, the players walked. Sure enough, the strike happened, so Schlope got to live out his dream of kicking for the Buffalo Bills right there in his hometown. Schlope said, "I wanted to play football," he told the Buffalo News in 2017 on the 30th anniversary of the game. "I wanted to get a shot. There's no minor leagues for football. Being a kicker, there's one job on every team. That's it. I was itching for the opportunity to get more swings." In his first 2 games, Schlope did not attempt a field goal. He missed one of his 2 extra point attempts, and then in this game, which would be the last of his brief career, he missed from 30 yards in the second quarter and then 44 yards in the third. However, after the Giants broke a gruesomely ugly scoreless tie with a field goal early in the fourth quarter, made possible by a Riddick fumble, the Bills mounted a drive behind quarterback
Brian McClure.
Oh, I remember him. Wow. When it stalled, Schlope came through, tying the game with a 31-yard field goal with 2 minutes and 58 seconds left to play, sending the crowd into a frenzy. The game seemed destined for overtime, but the Bills had to dodge a bullet when Carl Byrum lost a fumble at the Buffalo 22-yard line with 16 seconds remaining, only to have New York kicker George Bagnola miss from 40 yards as time expired, as Giants coach Bill Parcells nearly lost his mind. In overtime, the Bills won the coin toss and drove to the 18-yard line, but with a chance to win it, Schlope duck-hooked a chip shot from 28 yards. The team traded punts, and with 4 minutes and 43 seconds left and New York on the move, Buffalo's Steve Clark intercepted Rutledge, and a few plays later, Byrum broke a 30-yard run to the 6-yard line. On second and goal from the 10-yard line, Marv Levy sent Schlope onto the field for a 27-yard attempt with 19 seconds remaining, and this time, the local hero came through. I think his father was my math teacher, by the way. Very, very cool guy. You would have thought the Bills had won the Super Bowl as they stormed onto the field to celebrate as the fans went wild. It was fandemonium, as Van Miller used to say. Schlope said, "I can honestly say, my whole life, I've thought about just such an occasion as right now. It's an awesome feeling. I grew up in this town. I grew up on the Buffalo Bills. I knew every Buffalo kicker and what they were doing through my whole life. I remember Pete Gogolak when I was a kid, and John Leipold and Nick Mike Meyer." Schlope's NFL career ended that day, and he put his film degree to use and became a cameraman in Hollywood for both movie and television. He subsequently married Olympic skier Holly Flanders, and their son Alex Schlope won a freestyle skiing gold medal at the 2011 Winter X Games. Yet, despite all that success in Buffalo, he is most remembered for kicking the winning field goal in a game of which Levy said it was the worst football game ever. It may have been. So, interesting article. Let me pause for a second here to remind you that you are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Democrat and Chronicle on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. And let me take the pause that refreshes here just a second. All right, let's see here. All right, here's an article about the Buffalo Bills again. Sorry, but this is more recent. Five things. The headline is, five things that stood out in the Bills' horrendous Week 6 loss to the Atlanta Falcons. The Buffalo Bills have never lost the first game after their bye week in the Sean McDermott coaching era. It's a perfect 8-0. This would be a pretty good year to keep that streak alive because for the first time since McDermott arrived in 2017, the Bills have lost two straight games going into their bye, the latest one being Monday night's Mercedes-Benz Stadium meltdown, an eye-opening 24-14 loss to the Falcons that was an embarrassing performance in every way. McDermott, a weary-looking McDermott, said this was not the result we were looking for. His grasp of the obvious goes unstated. He said that after watching his team get outgained 443 yards for Atlanta and 291 yards for Buffalo, which is so unusual. Indicative of how much the Falcons bullied the Bills in a way the Bills usually bully their opposition. McDermott said, "I thought the guys played hard, in particular the second half. They fought through some injuries. Guys were stepping up. Injuries are not an excuse. There's no such thing as a moral victory, but I did think they battled right down to the end right there, which I appreciate. We'll work hard at it. We've got to figure it out. It's not going to be easy, but we've got to figure it out, and we'll work our tails off to get it done. Life in the NFL comes at you fast, and wow, have the tables turned on this once glorious-looking 2025 season. One that saw the Buffalo Bills jump out to a 4-0 start, which stirred fans into making sure that their schedules will clear for Super Bowl week outside San Francisco in early February. Yeah, well, let's pump the brakes on that, because in the blink of an eye, the Bills are 4-2, and not even in first place in the AFC East, having ceded that position to the New England Patriots, their conquerors from a week ago. I thought they were tied for first at 4-2. Well, what do I know? It was rather stunning to see the Bills get overwhelmed by a Falcons team that, while individually talented, certainly won't have any reason to keep its schedule open for early February. What a nice thing to say. And now, as the Bills limp into their mini vacation, one that could not come at a better time given their recent play and their mounting injury situation, the Bills are a team that suddenly has more questions than the SAT exam. Offense, defense, special teams, coaching, roster construction, it's all in play for what will be a long, miserable week off before they get back into action on October 26th against the Carolina Panthers. Josh Allen said, "It's going to eat at me for the next 2 weeks. A lot of stuff to clean up. We'll put our focus to our next opponent and go from there." Well, the writer says, here are a few observations I had. The first play of the game was an omen. If you didn't start getting a feeling that this wasn't going to be the Bills' night when minutes before the kickoff it was announced that Daquan Jones hurt his calf in a pregame warm-up and could not play, then surely that realization would hit you, had to hit you, on the first snap from scrimmage. Atlanta's superstar running back Brian Robinson had the ball punched out of his grasp by Dorian Williams and Christian Benford and was recovered at the Falcons' 46. Screech! Put the brakes on. Greg Rousseau was offside on the play, so the Falcons retained possession. Four plays later, the Falcons were in the end zone. And it didn't even feel like the Bills' defense was on the field. As Tyler, another running back for Atlanta, Tyler Allgeier, broke a 21-yard touchdown run. So it was a mind-numbing mistake, and McDermott was clearly aggravated after the game. I mean, lining up on sides, McDermott said. We police it during practice, and then it turns up in the game. So we have to take responsibility for that and making sure we're not beating ourselves. That's step number one. Let's get lined up on sides. When you think of the money these guys are paid and to make such a elementary error. Anyway, so that was just the beginning of a brutal night first half for the defense. By halftime, the Bills had allowed 9.1 yards per play for a total of 335 yards in the first half alone. Unbelievable. And they were a foot away from being down 28-7 when the Atlanta receiver Drake London, who made very few mistakes and a lot of catches, nearly scored a 40-yard touchdown on the final play, a mistake so unbelievable, you had to laugh. So this is a mistake by the Atlanta receiver, Drake London. And on that play, which began with 6 seconds to go and the Falcons out of timeouts, they were just trying to get the ball a little closer for a field goal attempt. Instead, the Bills had Jamarcus Ingram filling in for Christian Benford, who had gotten hurt one-on-one with London. It was a gift from the Bills' defensive coordinator, Bobby Babbage. I guess Jamarcus Ingram is an untried rookie. And the Atlanta quarterback, Michael Penix, knew right where to go with the ball. Ingram fell down, Jesus, and London was off to the races. But thanks to Taylor Rapp's hustling, he was able to force London out at the one-yard line, which replay confirmed after the initial call of a touchdown. The defense was much better in the second half and kept the Bills in it, but it did not matter because Allen and the offense couldn't do a thing. I mean, how often do you see that? Incredibly, with Robinson rushing for 170 yards, London catching 158 yards worth of passes. It was the first time in Bills history where they have allowed a 150-yard rusher and a 150-yard receiver in the same game. Tackling remains a nightmare. The Bills are one of the worst tackling teams in the league, which is shocking. One of the worst tackling teams in the league. And it's a big reason why they gave up so many explosive plays in the first half alone. They yielded six Atlanta gains of at least 20 yards, including an 81-yard scamper by Robinson, on which Cole Bishop committed a flat-out whiff. Nickel cornerback Teron Johnson said the first half wasn't good enough. Well, duh. It just wasn't good enough. We've got to do better. I feel like in the second half we did do better, but we got to be more consistent. At the end of the day, I feel like we had opportunities to win this game and we didn't make those plays. McDermott is clearly frustrated by the malfunction in fundamentals. He said, keep working it, when asked how it can improve, making sure we're executing the right technique. There's techniques that are involved in that at the end of the day. Run through a man, right? It's not easy. That's a good back. It's a really good back. And at the end of the day, we've got to be better tackling. When he says that's a good back, he's referring to the Atlanta halfback who gained 150 yards. Injuries. Injuries decimated the Bills. It was already worrisome when the inactives were announced and tight end Dalton Kincaid, which is Josh's favorite target, was ruled out with his oblique injury. I don't know what an oblique is. Pardon me for just a second. Okay. And then, not only Dalton Kincaid, but then in a game where the Bills knew their run defense would be severely challenged by the Atlanta halfback, Mr. Robinson, Jones somehow hurt his calf in warm-up and was ruled out. Then, during the game, the Bills began dropping like bowling pins. They lost wide receiver Joshua Palmer to an ankle injury in the second quarter. Linebacker Terrell Bernard went down with an ankle injury late in the first half, and neither returned. Great. Bishop missed some time due to cramps that forced Jordan Poyer, one of my all-time favorites, into the game, and Benford then hurt his Achilles, but he was able to return. Thank God. Injuries to the defense have been a problem since the start of training camp, and it has continued into the season. Thankfully, the suspensions of defensive lineman Michael Hoecht, H-O-E-C-H-T, and Larry Ogunjobi are finished, so they can get back to the team for the Panthers game. Well, that's good news. These were two guys that the Bills traded for and then learned that they had been suspended for the first five or six games of the season. Smooth. All right, the other factor, the Bills' offensive line was dominated. Rarely does the Bills' stellar offensive line get worked over the way it did by the Falcons' young, aggressive, and vicious pass rush. But it was a jailbreak almost every time Allen dropped back to pass. I remember. The Falcons were getting there with four players, a four-man rush. And then when they dialed up blitzes, the Bills had no idea how to stop it, and Allen was running for his life and was either sacked four times for 23 yards or had to throw the ball to receivers who, as usual, were not open and essentially dooming the plays. The Bills center, Connor McGovern, said that the Falcons were doing a great job bringing multiple guys. The offensive line for the Bills is a five-man production. And the Falcons were bringing six and seven guys. Load one way, bringing things the other way. It looked like they spent all week just studying themselves, and they had a good number for us. A lot of times when we were sliding, we thought pressure was coming, and they were doing a good job showing safeties down and rolling it the other way and slanting guys this way. not sure I'm following that analysis, but regardless. According to a statistics agency or service, the Falcons blitzed Allen on 56% of his dropbacks. That's one out of every two plays they blitzed. Wow. And that's the highest blitz rate he has seen in a game since 2021, 4 years ago. Allen completed just 15 of 26 for 180 yards with two interceptions, both coming on balls that were initially deflected at the line of scrimmage because of pressure. I didn't know that. Well, that's if they were deflections, that makes it a little easier to stomach. McDermott said it was too hard tonight on our quarterback. You have to evaluate everything to make sure we're looking in the right spots in terms of the coverages we're getting and the quarterback's progression overall. It doesn't need to be that hard all the time where he's having to run out of the pocket. Their pressure, I thought at times we picked up the pressure, and then other times the pocket was getting affected early. So the rush and coverage, we talk about that. It was disrupting our offense too early in the down. And then what about offensive coordinator Joe Brady? Should he recalibrate his play calling? As bad as it was in pass protection, the offensive line was fine in the run game, as the Bills averaged 5.6 yards per attempt, with James Cook gaining 87 yards. Let me just pause for a second to remind you that you are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Democrat and Chronicle on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The Bills have the reigning league MVP at quarterback, but it is now quite obvious that their passing game is sluggish at best, and they need to be a running team in order to succeed. Unfortunately, offensive coordinator Joe Brady didn't realize that soon enough in this game. Cook carried just 7 times in the first half, but then on the first possession of the third quarter, he carried 5 times for 37 yards, and he teed it up for Allen to throw a 16-yard TD pass to Ray Davis that cut the Bills' deficit to 21-14. But obviously, that's all they were going to get. And what happened after that? Well, on the Bills' next possession, after the drive was kept alive twice by Falcons penalties on third downs, the Bills were in a 4th-and-2 at the Atlanta 46, and Cook came off the field in favor of Ty Johnson. And Brady called for a pass. Allen got pressured, and he wound up flicking a pass toward Johnson that fell incomplete, and we had a turnover on downs. Even worse, on the next series, right after Rousseau had blocked a field goal, which seemed to give the Bills a new life, the Bills had 3rd-and-1 at their 48. Cook was off the field again, and the play call was a reverse to Elijah Moore, who fumbled the exchange, and while he recovered, he also lost 4 yards, and the Bills had to punt. The Bills had 3 possessions with a chance to tie the game with a touchdown and came away with no points, and they never scored again after that Davis touchdown. Against New England, Brady's tight end reverse to Dawson Knox ended in a fumble that handed 3 points to the Patriots. After that game, McDermott said he thought Brady had, quote, got too cute, close quote. Monday, all he said was, quote, we can be better. It was coaching malfeasance of the highest order, and it might have very well cost the Bills a chance to win. All right, let's try something different. Pardon me for a second here. All right, this is really more in the line of politics. Students at the University of Rochester on a hunger strike over the Gaza conflict. But I think the Gaza conflict, unless I'm wrong, I thought it was resolved for the most part with a few few exceptions. The six University of Rochester students who launched a hunger strike this week said the only way to circumvent the school's strict rules on protests was to put their own bodies on the line. Students and officials from the university have repeatedly clashed over the handling of protests related to the Israel-Hamas war. Over the last 2 years, many students took to campus green spaces and administrative buildings to rally support for a ceasefire in Gaza and to call on the University of Rochester to sever ties with Israeli institutions. Several dozen students faced probation, suspension, expulsion for protesting outside of university regulations. A University of Rochester student said, "Well, we tried. We used our voices. We did silent protests. We did a lot. And none of our demands were ever met by the university. We have to make them listen in a different way." The six students who launched a hunger strike on October 15th said they will not eat until the university meets three demands described in a letter from the Students for Justice in Palestine. Number one, issue a statement. They want the university to issue a statement of support acknowledging the devastation in Gaza. Well, that's a no-brainer. Hold a campus town hall on free speech and protest. And third, begin the process of divesting from Israeli tech and weapons industries. A university spokesperson said university officials received a letter, but, quote, do not know who's behind this email and will not be responding. She said the Students for Justice in Palestine is not a, quote, recognized group, close quote, at the university. A small group of students, including non-strikers, gathered along Riverside Park on campus on October 16th in support of the hunger strike. It was notably a quieter protest than prior gatherings, with no chanting or speeches. Alina Risas, a University of Rochester senior, said the university's efforts to dismantle peaceful protests have cast a negative stereotype on Palestinian students. Just a second. All right, that the peaceful protests have cast a negative stereotype on Palestinian students like herself and left them feeling isolated and rejected. The young woman, Ali, who is also Palestinian, said the university has failed to condemn or acknowledge the death and destruction in Gaza, even as other international scholars have begun to characterize the conflict as a genocide. That's a very serious allegation, and it may well be true. An Israeli bombing campaign has killed more than 67,000 Palestinians in Gaza, and nearly 2 million others were forced to flee their homes during the last 2 years. Israel and Hamas last week announced a ceasefire and agreed to exchange hostages in the latest attempt to end the conflict along the Gaza Strip. It is too early to tell if the ceasefire will hold. Humanitarian organizations are rushing to deliver aid to a region devastated by warfare and famine. The young Palestinian student said that this situation directly affects her people. The violence continues regardless of whether there is a ceasefire or not. The ceasefire does not mean freedom. It does not mean that the oppression will end toward my people. She says she believes that there are fewer than 10 Palestinian students on campus. Most of them have formed a support network. She said, "It feels a lot of the times that our existence as Palestinians is considered threatening. We're being weaponized and politicized as a people. We are not deemed just ordinary people, ordinary students that are going to the University of Rochester like anyone else's. When you're targeting this small group, it really is painful." Another University of Rochester senior named Erin Hess said she chose to participate in the hunger strike because it was a way to send a message without the fear of repercussions. Students want the university to divest in weapons and tech companies with ties to Israel. A similar student-led movement at the University of Rochester during South African apartheid in the late 1980s was successful. Hess said that this university, and more importantly, the city of Rochester, has a rich history of standing against apartheid, a rich history of civil rights, and I believe that my education and my right to protest are deeply intertwined. I'm deeply saddened that I have to choose between one or the other. From sit-ins, or protests, or encampments, we've tried everything under the sun, she added. So students have only gotten suspended and people are still dying, so this is just another attempt. Okay. What? Okay, bear with me. All right, this will probably be the final article of the morning. United States Postal Service employee was tragically shot outside an upstate New York post office. Shooter still at large. An employee was shot in the parking lot at the U.S. Post Office Main Jefferson Road office in Henrietta, according to the Monroe County Sheriff's Office. Deputies said the employee was shot while he was sitting in his own car parked in the employee parking lot at about 12:45 in the morning, October 16th. The employee was taken to an area hospital where he was treated and released. The injuries were not considered life-threatening. Thank God. The victim and his vehicle were both struck with gunfire. The shooter fled the area in a vehicle before emergency responders arrived at the scene. No charges have been filed in connection with the incident. Deputies are investigating the shooting along with United States Postal Inspectors and other federal partners. The sheriff's office used its canine unit and drones at the scene to search for the shooter. Investigators on Thursday are reviewing video and interviewing witnesses. The post office on Jefferson Road is just east of Interstate 390. The office reopened Thursday morning. Its hours typically are 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., according to the post office website. Monroe County understands that these incidents cause concern and fear for our community members. We will continue to work closely with our partners to ensure that those responsible for this incident are held accountable. The policeman also clarified that reports circulating that the shooting victim returning fire and a residence in Pittsford being involved, quote, are inaccurate based on the evidence we have at this time. Okay, well, all right, and there you have it. You have been listening to a reading of articles and features from the October 16th issue of the Democrat and Chronicle. Your reader has been George Collins. Thank you so much for listening, and have a wonderful day.